Welcome to the Background Briefing podcast. This year has seen a huge jump in the number of people diagnosed with Ross River virus, which is transmitted by a mosquito bite and it can produce debilitating arthritis-like symptoms. The hotspot for the current outbreak is the coastal strip from Brisbane down to Port Macquarie. Mosquito scientists say it's a sign of things to come as climate change extends the insect's habitat and breeding season, and new suburbs are pushed further into the mangroves and marshlands that are prime biting zones. The large numbers of recently installed rainwater tanks are also proving to be ideal breeding areas for mosquitoes all year round. This is Ian Townsend's report.
Just south of the Queensland border and within sight of the high rises of the Gold Coast, planes are bombing mangroves with insecticide to keep mosquitoes at bay. This is the epicentre of a big outbreak of Ross River virus. There have been 6,000 cases reported across the country so far this year, and that's already more than the number of cases recorded for the entire year last year. Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Townsend, and we're in the mangroves along the Tweed River in northern New South Wales, where the suburbs of the Gold Coast spill across the Queensland border. It's one of the fastest growing urban areas of the country, and this mangrove is the home of the saltwater mosquito Aedes vigilax, one of the main culprits in what's shaping up as Australia's largest outbreak of Ross River virus. I'm being given a guided tour of this virus hot zone by two mangrove scientists, John Knight from Griffith University and Patrick Dwyer from Fisheries New South Wales.
The saltwater mosquito that we're trying to do our work on, the one that carries Ross River virus, that mosquito can travel, when wind assisted, up to 50 kilometres. So reducing its habitat is actually what we really need to do. Oh, you've got mosquitoes literally all over your face.
I think you've got about 50 mosquitoes on your arms there. Yep. Now, you could ask yourself the question, how much of this could you put up with? And the answer is, not very much.
I'd like to get out of here.
Yes.
There are millions of them. There's people just living only a few metres from here.
Yes.
They're just there. Yes.
It's been a wet and warm summer, and as I walk the short distance from the mangroves to the houses to speak to a few residents, it's starting to rain again.
Helen, there's a man here who wants to talk to you.
Hi. How are you?
I'm Ian, how are you? I'm wondering whether, because I just had a walk down there and got...
Eaten alive.
Do they bother you over here?
We do get quite a bit of mosquitoes. I spray with citronella oil and also Listerine, and it seems to keep them at bay.
Works?
Just a little bit. But you don't walk about 6 o'clock at night because you just,
Even just out here?
And they sting quite hard, yeah. It's the price you pay for living down here.
The price you pay for living here is being bitten by a number of mosquito species, and if you're unlucky, by a mosquito carrying the Ross River virus. This virus causes a disease doctors describe as epidemic polyarthritis. Since the start of the year, most of Australia's Ross River cases have been reported between Brisbane and Port Macquarie. One of those who's been infected is Samantha May, who lives on the Gold Coast.
I couldn't lift the kettle up properly, so I'd have to almost have two hands and you can't get the hot part. Things like opening the milk was really difficult, and I was relieved to have a diagnosis of Ross River because I'd self-diagnosed myself with rheumatoid and was really frightened that, you know. And I guess being a nurse, it has actually given me a better insight into what people with rheumatoid or any chronic condition, what it's like every day, that you feel more tired and don't have the energy but you look fine, and it's just really gets you down. You just think, it is wearing.
Councils in Queensland spend about $10 million a year on mosquito control, and that's likely to keep rising. Working with local councils is the head of the mosquito lab at QIMR Berghofer, Greg Devine.
And there is an awful lot of people who are going to be at risk in the future as our towns and cities expand, and they're particularly expanding along the coast and former good mosquito habitat and bushland and wetland, and an awful lot of people are going to run the risk of being exposed.
Greg Devine says we're putting ourselves at increased risk of being bitten by mosquitoes that have the potential to transmit a number of viruses, not just Ross River, but Barmer Forest, Chikungunya and Dengue. While there have been 6,000 confirmed cases of Ross River this year, it's estimated only 1 in 5 people go to the doctor. As many as 30,000 people could have been infected since the start of the year, but most get only mild symptoms. There's now evidence that small changes to the climate are making things better for the mosquitoes and therefore the virus. The preferred habitat of the saltwater mosquito, mangroves, are spreading out.
You can map that out, you can see it on Google imagery. If you look at old Landsat imagery and then compare it with current imagery, you can see how mangroves appear to be marching across the environment.
Pat Dale is an emeritus professor at Griffith University and she studies mosquito habitats.
It's related to rainfall, it's certainly related to climate change. It may be related to sea level rise, but it's certainly happening, and not just in the study sites that I've referred to, but also along the whole east coast of Australia.
Because we've always been worried about the loss of mangrove habitat. Is it that they're increasing or just moving?
They're increasing, and that's been documented for quite some time.
Here at Terranora, just south of the Queensland border, the mangroves are not only increasing in area, the ground they sit on, the spongy mass of roots and sediment, is rising at a rate of 5 millimetres a year. Parts of the mangroves are now sitting almost half a metre higher than they were this time last century. Dr. John Knight's been taking core samples to measure them.
It's very likely that local water level changes have driven the 5 millimetres a year, but whether it's because of local sea level rise, global sea level rise, we're still working that out.
The mangroves appear to be rising to deal with the fact that the water's rising. Around the globe, the sea level's rising at different rates in different places, and it's a complicated picture. The rain and high tides along the Queensland and New South Wales coast has made this year particularly bad for mosquitoes, and the suburban fringe is moving further into the mosquito biting zone.
So all of this is farmland. There's a new fence being put in, separating the creek from the cows.
Cattle and horses still graze the lower swampy flats here, a handy blood meal for the breeding female mosquitoes. A hillside nearby is being cleared for more homes, and a road's been cut into the slope right down to these tidal flats and salt marshes. The houses are moving closer to the mangroves, and the mangroves are moving across the salt marsh closer to the houses. People want to live close to the water here, and there's not much that councils can do about that if a developer already owns the land, except ask them to make sure the new homes have screens. I'm driving along a mud track between the houses and the mangroves with mangrove scientist John Knight and Patrick Dwyer from Fisheries New South Wales.
You can see here that the mangroves are all encroached. All of that was salt marsh area, and now it's become increasingly dense mangrove forest for mangrove Avicennia marina.
And there's a blood meal wandering in front of us here.
Quite a lot of them.
Come on, move it, Horson. I don't think they want to move.
Cows and horses.
What's happening here on the left, sorry?
This is part of the development.
Yeah, so that's all camphor laurel that's been cut down and cleared and laid up, and I suppose they're going to start the next component of
the housing estate.
Shaping some of that land and working it up for development.
Well, you'll be able to chuck a rock from your front veranda there into the mangroves if you wanted to. It's so close.
Yes, it's terribly close.
Researchers believe that this year there's been an explosion in mosquito numbers that's coincided with a large outbreak of Ross River virus in its natural hosts, thought to be kangaroos and wallabies, and the virus has been spilling over into other species, such as horses, possums and people. Mosquito researcher at QIMR Berghofer, Greg Devine.
There's an element of cycling that goes through the possum population, and ultimately it's even been suggested that for some big epidemic outbreaks, then even human-to-human or even horses have been implicated as well. So once epidemics get very large, then all kinds of other things can possibly come in to maintain the cycle of transmission.
Many of the people moving here are sea and tree changers, often retirees with the usual aches and pains that come with ageing. Local GPs have been referring what appear to be rheumatoid arthritis cases to specialised arthritis clinics. Jenny Ung is one of four doctors at the Paradise Arthritis and Rheumatology Clinic at Southport on the Gold Coast.
In the last few weeks, each of us would have about 4 or 5 cases each, and that's really quite not something we would normally see.
So the cases appearing in your surgery because GPs are referring them to you for arthritis and you're picking up Ross River?
That's correct. So some of them are sent to us thinking, oh, could this be rheumatoid? Because sometimes they get joint swelling, you see, and so people think, oh, this must be rheumatoid. Also, our own patient population, so our rheumatoid patients, you know, they think, oh, is this a flare-up? But it's actually not. It's actually Ross River on top of their rheumatoid.
The main symptoms are identical to rheumatoid arthritis. Within 2 to 19 days of being bitten by an infected mosquito, some people start to get severe pain in their joints, as well as fatigue, fever, and sometimes a rash. The pain and fatigue can last up to 30 to 40 weeks. Samantha May is a nurse. Her mother had rheumatoid arthritis, so when Samantha woke up one morning 5 weeks ago with severe pain and swollen joints, she thought, this is it. It turned out to be Ross River fever.
Even silly things like squeezing the tea bag was more awkward. And I think for me, the luxury has been, and I haven't fallen in too much of a heap, is because I did have the sick leave. I was encouraged to take it. And I've got a really supportive husband who has, you know, picked up jobs and things, so I'm not running around. I've been very lucky. When I did see the GP, he had just seen a young woman who was the carer for, I think, her mother, and had a baby that she couldn't pick up and obviously was really distressed. And she was on her own. So she's got a family to look after. She can't lift things. She's in pain and there's nothing she can do about it, really.
Samantha May had to take time off from her job, and she's been paying extra to get her groceries delivered. She's also seen the doctor several times. All that can be expensive. Queensland University of Technology virologist Dr. John Askov has been researching Ross River virus for most of his career.
We know that the direct medical costs, if you just assume that everybody goes to a doctor with a set of Ross River-like symptoms, they have a blood test and they come back and get the results. That's costing us $20 million a year just for that. So that's just the diagnostic component. Now, if people are off work and there's additional health costs, we really have no idea of what that is.
John Askov based that $20 million figure on his understanding that 200,000 blood tests are done for Ross River virus each year. There is one study that we're aware of that estimates the community cost of each diagnosed Ross River virus case. It was done about 10 years ago. Based on today's dollar value, it's about $1,400 per person. Using that estimate, the 6,000 confirmed cases so far this year have cost the community between $8 and $9 million. The severity of symptoms, and therefore the cost, varies, and we don't really know how many cases go undiagnosed. The people most affected by this virus are in the prime of their working and family lives.
The clinical symptoms occur most commonly in the 25 to 45 year age group. This is your childbearing age group.
John Askov is also director of the World Health Organization's Collaborating Centre for Arbovirus Reference and Research. He started working on a Ross River virus vaccine 30 years ago.
And, you know, if you're a young mum and you're trying to look after a family and things, and you can't open the fridge door and can't turn on a tap and can't dress the kids and so on, it's a really distressing couple of months. Now, there's no dollar value on that, but if you talk to somebody who's been in that circumstance, they would have had the vaccine if it was available.
It was only a few months ago that the Ross River vaccine finally passed its Phase 3 human trials.
which means it's safe and likely to be effective and could be licensed and rolled out. But it's not been made available yet and may never be.
This disease is a cost which is not borne by the government. At the moment, all the health costs associated with Ross River is borne by individuals. It's costing the government nothing. What we're talking about here is shifting the cost of prevention to the government so that the public are no longer paying.
But it does sound as if there is a cost benefit if people were vaccinated.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, I think the technology is not going to go away, and it would be a very easy vaccine to make if somebody decided to pick up and go with it.
Beyond the current outbreak in Australia, Ross River virus has the potential to become a more global problem. In the late 1970s, an outbreak of Ross River virus exploded in Fiji, making tens of thousands of people sick. That huge outbreak was part of the reason John Askov started looking for a vaccine 30 years ago.
The first money we got was from the Cattlemen's Union. They ran a Cattle Queen competition each year, and the money went to a good cause, and that was the first funding we had to get started.
Eventually, the project was bought by the European arm of the Baxter Pharmaceutical Company, and last year human trials in Australia showed it worked and was safe. Before it could be licensed, though, Baxter sold off its vaccine projects. John Askov says he doesn't stand to make any money if the vaccine is eventually commercialised, and at this stage, he isn't exactly sure what's happened to it.
The research, Baxter Research Division, now has been broken up, and I'm unaware of who's got the rights to the Ross River vaccine at this very moment. I mean, this happened a couple of months ago.
Background Briefing has tracked the Ross River vaccine down to a Florida-based pharmaceutical company called Nanotherapeutics. It's been reported that Nanotherapeutics is buying Baxter's vaccine programs for Ross River and other mosquito-borne viruses, chikungunya and West Nile virus. The company's Vice President of Business Development, Gary Ascani, wrote in an email to Background Briefing,
"We are still in negotiations with Baxter and are not at liberty to discuss plans associated with a potential acquisition of the Ross River vaccine project."
The vaccine remains in limbo and its future in doubt.
I'm just not sure that Ross River fever has, if you like, made it into the higher echelons of prioritisation, and there may be a range of reasons for that.
Tim James is the Chief Executive of Medicines Australia, which represents the pharmaceutical industry here.
There are three key drivers, if you like, of which products would be brought forward more readily and more quickly and more feasibly by the industry would be, number one, what is the clinical need? Number two, what is the capacity to treat? And number three, what is the commercial feasibility? So in terms of clinical need, Ross River fever happening as it does in Australia and a few other nations in this part of the world, it's not a global condition. Its impact upon people obviously shouldn't be understated, but it's not ending life.
The hope was to make the Ross River vaccine part of the immunisation schedule and have teenagers vaccinated. One shot gives lifelong immunity. John Askov.
A commercial partner would want to know that there was a likelihood of a market. And Australians are notorious for not paying for anything. You know, if childhood vaccines are not free on the schedule, people tend to not pay for them. So I think for a Ross River vaccine to be useful, it would need to be a part of the recommended immunisation schedule, and it would probably need to be given to teenagers and be subsidised. And so I think that's a discussion at the government level.
So what are the costs involved in rolling it out?
Well, the cost it would be in putting it in ampoules.
So how significant would that be?
I have no idea what it would cost to do that. And then there's the delivery costs as well. So somebody's got to turn up and they've got to immunise the kids and those sorts of issues.
So not that terribly much by the sound of it.
No, I don't think so.
To be eligible for government funding, the vaccine would have to go to the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee, which could recommend the vaccine to be listed on the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme, the PBS, and included in the National Immunisation Program. Glenn Salkeld is a health economist and a professor of public health at the University of Sydney. He's also a former member of the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee.
That committee looks at a number of different factors: how many people will benefit, the total cost of funding a vaccine or a particular drug, the prevalence of the disease. And I guess vaccine campaigns can be costly if you need to vaccinate a large number of people, but all of that goes into the mix. So I think where it becomes difficult is where you've got a large cost for a small number of potential beneficiaries. And that's where the experts have to weigh up the numbers and the context of it and make a difficult choice.
A spokesperson for the Federal Department of Health says the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee hasn't received any submission yet from a pharmaceutical company for a Ross River virus vaccine to be added to the PBS. Without a vaccine, we're back to old-fashioned and low-tech solutions, such as using repellent and screening houses to stop mozzies from biting us. Pat Dale from Griffith University.
Preventing Ross River is cost-effective, and mosquito control can help do that. Building regulations can help do that. Planning can help do that. Individuals can take personal responsibility, and all those things together will lead to a reduced incidence.
Some councils have maps to show where mosquitoes are really bad, for instance, within a certain distance of mangroves, and they ask developers to put screens on any new houses built in those areas. The Sunshine Coast Regional Council, for example, had a draft development plan with what's called a biting insect map overlay, which identified mosquito hotspots. It was part of a list of overlays that included areas identified as being at risk from other hazards, such as flooding and bushfires. Recently, Pat Dale noticed that the biting insect map overlay had been removed by the Sunshine Coast Council.
It was a low-level control. It said if you're going to develop these areas, all houses must be screened. Unfortunately, those overlays were all removed. And I actually checked this morning just to make sure, because the mosquito control people have been telling me that. I thought, just check that they're right. And they are right. Those overlays are no longer there.
Is it to encourage development or to make it easier for developers somehow?
The actual overlay didn't really inhibit development. Putting on screens on a house, well, you would think a good developer would do that automatically. And if people don't like screens, well, they can take them off. But the other reason might be that when you buy a property, your solicitor or whoever does the conveyancing will do searches for you and tell you what are the constraints, what are the conditions, are there main roads going to go in your area? They would find this overlay and tell people you're in a mosquito-prone area.
Background Briefing contacted the Sunshine Coast Regional Council to ask why the biting insect maps had been discontinued. In a written statement, the council said the mosquito problem could be dealt with in other ways, through its planning process, and removing the maps made the process more efficient. It said removing the maps had no impact on the council's mosquito control program. There is another low-tech and effective way to reduce the number of mosquitoes breeding in the mangroves. The saltwater mosquito, Aedes vigilax, breeds in large ponds of stagnant water in mangroves, the water pools behind ridges that are only a few centimetres high and filled by the occasional spring tide. Pat Dale pioneered a technique to dig shallow channels, called runnels, into these stagnant ponds to let the normal tides flush them out.
Particularly in the mangroves, we improve water quality in some of the parts of it, the basins which don't get much tidal flushing, where dissolved oxygen can go down to zero. Well, fish don't live in that. When we increase that flushing, we remedy that dissolved oxygen problem, and fish can get in and get in greater numbers and so become a better manager of mosquitoes by eating them.
In trial sites, runnelling has halved the amount of insecticide sprayed on mangroves, and fish numbers have also increased. But there's also a growing mosquito risk in our backyards as more people reintroduce rainwater tanks. During a big drought last decade, the Queensland government subsidised 100,000 rainwater tanks in Brisbane. These tanks are ideal for mosquitoes. The common backyard mosquito in southeast Queensland is Aedes nodosciptus, another potential vector for Ross River virus. They simply lay their eggs in roof gutters, and the rain washes the microscopic eggs into the tank, where it's dark and warm all year round. The eggs hatch, and if the tank's well sealed, adult mosquitoes can't escape and they die, All it takes, though, is one small crack, a loose screw, or a small hole in a sieve, and suddenly the mosquitoes are out. Brendan Truen is a PhD student studying Brisbane's rainwater tanks. He's showing me a typical house tank in the suburb of Salisbury.
I think I saw a few mozzies coming out there.
This is a 80s No Descriptus. We have an emergence trap that I've designed on the top of the tank, and it's designed to allow us to know how many mosquitoes are actually coming out of the tank over a period of time. And that gives us an idea of the productivity of tanks. A survey we did of rainwater tanks during winter, when we wouldn't expect to see mosquitoes in tanks last winter, we found that 9 out of 10 actually at some stage had mosquitoes living in them.
9 out of 10?
Yes, during a 3-month survey of tanks. And it's really important because the coldest part of the year is when mosquitoes normally drop off in their population, but the buffered environment inside rainwater tanks actually provides a system where mosquitoes can actually avoid those extremes in temperature.
Brendan Truen's doing his PhD on rainwater tanks and the risk of them harbouring a particularly nasty mosquito called Aedes aegypti. That's the one responsible for North Queensland's current outbreaks of dengue fever. In the 1920s, Aedes aegypti caused an epidemic of dengue that infected 500,000 people in Queensland and New South Wales. Back then, everyone had a rainwater tank, and that's where the mozzies were breeding. Reticulated water schemes eventually put an end to the rainwater tanks in Brisbane, and as the tanks disappeared, so did the Aedes aegypti mosquito. Now the tanks are back, and the dengue mosquito isn't far away. It's been found breeding in rainwater tanks a few hundred kilometres north of Brisbane. In Brisbane itself, Aedes nodoscriptus, the common backyard mosquito, is already breeding in the tanks. This mosquito is one of several implicated in the current Ross River virus outbreak. Brendan Truen, the man studying mosquitoes and rainwater tanks, has just been diagnosed with Ross River fever.
You know, I think I caught it around my house.
Do you live near a mangrove area? Or?
No, I don't. I'm in the middle of Brisbane. Data from the traps from Brisbane City Council at the moment are showing that the actual disease is found all the way across Brisbane.
So we have a potential vector there in your hand, nodoscriptus. Do you think that might have been responsible?
It's one of a number of suspects.
What were the symptoms?
I have sore ankles, sore joints in my ankle, and also in my hips. I haven't had any type of flu or fever associated with that, but it can be much worse.
When were you diagnosed?
Just diagnosed last week, actually.
Last week?
Yes. I didn't think it was anything besides muscle pain from riding my bicycle. But after about 4 weeks of continual pain and it actually impacting the way that I walked, I decided to get a test, and it happened to be Ross River.
The mosquito Brendan Truen is finding in Brisbane's tanks is one of about 20 different species that have the potential to spread Ross River virus. And these mozzies are found right across the country. This year, Ross River cases have been notified in every state and territory, including the ACT. All you really need are native animals carrying the virus and the right mosquito to bite and transmit it.
We had so many mosquitoes here. We've been spraying madly.
We heard earlier from Samantha May. She lives in a rural residential area behind the Gold Coast.
And I had, you know, mosquitoes bites all over my arms and legs.
I mean, this is nice. There's lots of wildlife.
Lots of wallabies.
Lots of wallabies. Do you think they're the culprits?
I don't know. I did hear that wallabies are carriers. So we have wallabies that will sit literally out on the grass in front, and they'll also sleep all around the stables, and you can get probably nearly 2 metres away from them. They don't move anymore because they're so used to it. So that possibly doesn't help.
Are there other people, any neighbours at all that you know of who might have developed Ross River?
Another neighbour has got Ross River, and there's another lady who's been waiting for her test to come back.
Since putting out a call on social media, Background Briefing has been contacted by a number of people who want to explain how bad the symptoms can be. One of them is Yvonne Willis, the mother of a 5 and a 12-year-old who's been suffering for 3 months.
opening doors, keys in door locks, opening jars, turning on taps, all those things. My wrists were so painful and my hands actually weren't quite functioning. I'm still dropping things in the kitchen today through lack of being able to grip something properly or lift heavy saucepans and things like that. I hadn't experienced anything like it before. It's, I'd say, 10 times worse than getting the flu.
Yvonne lives at Benora Point in northern New South Wales, very close to the Terranora mangroves, where the spraying for mosquitoes has been going on for months. Unfortunately, the mosquito breeding season is getting longer. Mangrove scientist John Knight.
In the last few years, the mosquito season has extended. It's both started earlier, back into August, and ended later. We could anticipate that mosquito production is going to continue here into May, maybe June.
Mosquitoes are breeding for most of the year now, and the human population of this part of the northern New South Wales coast is also growing fast. Housing estates are popping up everywhere. Patrick Dwyer from Fisheries New South Wales advises local councils on developments near mangroves.
Certainly right where we are, there's developments that have been approved just in the hillsides behind us. The area where we are is, I think, long-term population growth has been at about 2% or so. Sea change movement has been a big part of that. A lot of people's dream to live in these sort of areas. They're attracted to these areas for great opportunity to go fishing, enjoy the river, enjoy all these things. Unfortunately, if we don't plan and think about this correctly, our movement to these areas can exacerbate the hazard and bring problems that we don't want. So considering that in the planning system, not creating a new problem, that's what we're trying to achieve.
We might have to go. I think it's starting to rain a bit.
Drive and try and get some of your friends out. Oh, yeah.
Some mosquitoes are trying to hitch a ride back to Brisbane. The future of John Ascoff's vaccine is likely to depend on how far Ross River spreads and how frequently outbreaks occur. This year, the virus is on track to infect more people than ever in Australia, and John Ascoff believes the time for the vaccine is coming.
I would like to see this rolled out. I'd like to see this problem knocked on the head. I mean, from a personal point of view, you know, we created the problem by providing a simple, easy, robust test that saw the number of patients go from 5 to 5,000.
It's a problem that's not going to go away, and it could get worse. The spread of mosquitoes, global warming, all these things would work in the virus's favour.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing too is that this is not a complex vaccine. You know, I think one of the things that appealed is that, you know, you could grow an enormous amount of virus very, very simply. The real break for us would be an outbreak in southern states of the United States, because they've got the mosquitoes that can transmit Ross River. The sensible thing would be to have the vaccine available here, and then if anybody else needs it, they could get it.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research, Lawrence Bull. Technical production by Stephen Tilley. The executive producer is Chris Bullock, and I'm Ian Townsend.
Now, a clarification in relation to last week's Background Briefing program about the dangers of cosmetic surgery and the lack of regulation around the industry. In that program, there was reference to the death of Lauren James in 2007, 3 days after she had a cosmetic surgery procedure, liposuction. Background Briefing didn't make it clear that the surgeon who operated on Lauren James was a specialist plastic surgeon, not a cosmetic surgeon. This has been clarified at the Background Briefing website and in the story transcript.